the cinema giant.
What's going on, movie lovers? I'm Jeff, and this is the Cinema Judge. To all my regulars out there who show up every episode, thank you so very much. But now, if you're new to the show, I'm going to briefly tell you what we do here at the Cinema Judge. We love movies. We love sharing movies with you. The studios, they send us interviews, movie clips, on-set footage, interviews from the red carpet, all those things. What we do is very simple. We put those into one simple commercial, for lack of a better word. I'm the judge. You're the jury. I will never tell you not to see a movie or to see a movie. I'll just give you the facts. Maybe I'll tell you what I think of it. But we all walk different paths. Who am I to tell you what is good, what is bad? Because any movie is somebody's favorite movie. Because there's so much noise out there. I just like to give you guys the information and then just let it soak in. Because that's what it's all about to me. Consider this a movie oasis. A place where you can just sit down, escape from all the noise, and listen to one movie and all that they have to say about it. Because we all want to spend our hard-earned money wisely. Because we all want the same thing. An enjoyable movie experience. Now, talk about experiences, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. John Wick. If you're unfamiliar with John Wick, you need to check him out. Because this is the fourth installment. In a nutshell, the other movies were this. At one time, John Wick was an assassin. And he gave it all up for his wife. And during the first movie, his wife had passed. And for to help him mourn, she bought him a dog, a puppy. John has an altercation outside at a gas station with some Russian mobsters. Well, they come after him. And they do the worst thing possible. They kill his dog. I mean, nobody. You don't kill a man's dog. That's just low. Well, John doesn't take it too well. He goes on and hunts him down. And then movie after movie, the stakes get higher and higher. So let me give you a brief synopsis of what this movie's about. John Wick uncovers a path to defeating the High Table. But before he can earn his freedom, Wick must face off against a new enemy with powerful alliances across the globe and forces that turn old friends into foes. Ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, the trailer for John Wick Chapter 4.
Saying goodbyes?
Saying hello.
You think your wife can hear you?
No.
Why bother?
Maybe I'm wrong.
You're going to die.
Maybe not.
Goodbye to you, my trusted friend.
A new day is dawning. New ideas, new rules, new management.
We've known each other since we were 9 or 10.
Who is this?
The Marquis de Grammont.
Challenge him to single combat. Win or lose, it's a way out. I don't sit at the table.
Your family does.
Please pray for me. I was the black sheep of the family.
Man has to look his best when it's time to get married. Or buried.
I'm going to need a gun.
Goodbye, my friend. It's hard to die.
If you win, the table will honor its word. You'll have your freedom.
Under the old laws, only one can survive. Failure to meet at sunrise. Will result in execution.
Last words, Winston?
Just have fun out there.
I want you to find your peace. But a good death only comes after a good life.
You and I left a good life behind a long time ago, my friend.
Now, here's the funny thing about that trailer. The song that plays throughout that trailer is the incredible Terry Jack song, Seasons in the Sun. And it's a very sad song about a guy speaking his last words to family members as he's dying, because Terry Jacks wrote that about a friend of his who was dying of leukemia, and that song was dedicated to him. And not that it's funny, but a dear friend of mine who was just a lifelong hippie slash pacifist, she loved this song growing up, and to her, the friend that she grew up with, it was like their song. And so the irony that that kind of song is put into this movie, which is just a ballet of brutality, action, kung fu, everybody's dream when it comes to an action film, combining John Woo, Sam Peckinpah type violence, and just hand-to-hand combat, you name it, everything that usually that song doesn't stand for, but it fits ideally. That's what makes movies so wonderful. You could take a song that's really sad and then put it into a movie that's sheer action, bedlam. And again, this movie does have humor, so it's not just a straight-up all-out action movie and brutality. There is some great humor in it, and that's what sets a movie like this apart. But I just had to throw that out there. That just, when I first heard that trailer, I'm like, oh my goodness, Seasons in the Sun. But it works perfectly. Now, coming up first, we're going to hear from the director, Chad Stahelski. And he just talks about how he's a fan of this franchise and that he gets to work with Keanu Reeves. And you can just hear it in his voice about this is just a movie he just loves to do. It's not just a project and then, okay, now on to the next movie. You can just hear how much he's a fan and just how awe of Keanu Reeves he is.
I'd say first and foremost, I love working with Keanu Reeves. I think he's one of the best creative collaborative partners I could have ever wanted, let alone imagined. Keanu and I, every time, say, no, this is our last one. We're not going to do it again. We'll see what happens. Then we go on a press tour. It seems like every time at the Imperial Hotel in Tokyo, we'll sit around having a few drinks in their scotch bar. And we're like, ooh, that was a good one. Good thing, you know, glad it's done. Yeah, great. I got an idea. And it starts that way. And it starts with an idea on a napkin. And I honestly, at the end of it, I like the world. John Wick has elements of things in it that I grew up watching. It has a sensibility of a Western, of a samurai movie, of a wuxia kung fu film. It has an underworld side. It has mythology. It's got car chases, you know. Like, what other franchise can you put 70s-style car chases, attack dogs, samurais, ninja? You know, I don't know. So it didn't exist, and then we got to make it exist.
And that's what I love about that interview. He's talking about they just go out, they're at dinner, and they start writing down ideas. That the relationship that he must have with Keanu Reeves. And it's like that, you get that little behind-the-scenes image of moment of these two talented people. And like, hey, you know what? We could do this. Why don't we try that? I just love that behind-the-scenes kind of information that you might not always get. But it's really cool that he talks about how many genres that they've used to put inside these movies. And it's so hard to sum up, but it's so perfectly put together with so much stuff like that. And I remember growing up, I used to wait until like, I think it was like 2 or 3 in the morning on a Friday night, and I'd wait for Kung Fu Theater. It was something I looked forward to all week. And then some weeks it didn't happen. I'd wake up, I'd sneak out and I'd turn on TV. And I'm like, oh man, it's not on. But this movie captures part of that energy of when I was a kid watching these insanely unrealistic action sequences, but it didn't matter. They were fun. It was exciting. Something you don't see every day. And you know, it's way out of control madness. But this movie captures Westerns. It captures so many aspects of movies that we all love. And again, yes, it's extremely violent, but it's almost done in that way that it's not quite comic-y, not comic book-like, but it's so beautiful to watch. The choreographing, the training, the hours of input everybody takes to make these kind of sequences, and it makes it look so fluid. that's what's so great, because when I used to watch those Kung Fu theater movies in the middle of the night or late at night, whatever word you want to talk about, you knew they just studied and trained forever, and it just looked so fluid and natural, like just poetry and movement. And that's what this stuff is on, but on speed, because these scenes are intense. They're fast. They're incredible. And I just like how we tap into that, because that feeling that this movie gives people, it brings me back to when I was a kid. But coming up next, we're going to hear from the producer, Erica Lee. And it's really fun how she talks about what the original script was titled. And again, you don't get that all the time. So it's really fun to hear what it was originally titled and what pulled her into the project.
When I first read the first script for John Wick, it was first called Scorn. And I remember thinking that it was a really fun action movie. But what hooked me in was the dog. And I'm a dog lover. And I remember I emailed Basil and I said, I don't know if it's just me, but I'm really into this. I think it's the dog. It needs a lot of work, but I think that it's like the most sympathetic character. The bones are really great on this. We should figure it out. And then he replied, I agree. And then we optioned the script. We met with Derek, who was the original writer. We actually had a contest with our interns who could pick the best title for the script, because we thought Scorn sounded too much like a horror movie. And I remember Basil just goes, let's just call it John Wick. That's the name of the lead character. The actor will love it. And that actor became Keanu. And we started meeting and talking about directors. And Keanu had known Chad and Dave forever. We'd been aware of them, but we never really met them. We'd never done a movie with 8711. And they came in and they blew us away with their pitch, their take on the material, their nuance, the story, ideas that they had. And so then the team was born and we were kind of off to the races.
And just imagine if they had named it Scorn, would it still have had the impact? You know, it's only a name. It might have had no difference. But just how they just said, here's a contest. What do you guys think it should be named? You know, all that kind of stuff. Would that have altered the trajectory of this franchise at all? Again, maybe not at all. But coming up next, we have the writer of this film, Michael Finch. And he kind of gives us a brief synopsis of where the story's gone and where we left off Wick from the last movie and where they're at now. And then immediately after that, we're going to play a featurette. And in this featurette, you're going to hear interviews from the cast and crew talking about the stunts and the commitment and everything like that that's involved in this. So you're going to hear a whole bunch of interviews interspliced with scenes. And later on in the show, I'm going to give you a website that this is originally always a TV version, but I make it into this podcast. And if you want to watch these interviews and scenes and all these action sequences within this featurette, I'll give you that website so then you can watch the TV version of this in case you want to see some of that stuff. But in the meantime, here's the writer, Michael Finch, and then that featurette.
When we last left in 3, John had been shot off a roof. He'd been betrayed by Winston, and he's picked up by the Bowery King. The last lines of 3, the Bowery King asks him, are you mad? And, oh, yeah. And what John Wick does in 4 is an expression of that. 1 was the introduction of John Wick in this world. 2 was the consequences of reentering. 3 was John Wick being hunted for making a moral choice. Now, the moral choice involved violence, but he did what he and we believe is the right thing. And for that, he was hunted. He was on his heels the entire piece. We wanted in 4 to flip the paradigm and have the Baba Yaga go after the table. Essentially, 4 is the story of John saying, I am not going to run anymore. So instead of running from the table, he turns around and runs at them. And we start to understand actually why people are so afraid of John Wick. Woke up this morning.
You got yourself. We're here. Working on John Wick Chapter 4.
And so it begins.
3, 2, 1. Living in this time behind enemy
lines. And you have all that John Wick swag. Cars. The weapons, jiu-jitsu, but with Chapter 4, we took it to another level. And when I see you, I'm gonna take what I want, so.
Plan is out.
John Wick movies are known for Keanu Reeves doing the stunts.
It's been about 12 weeks of training. It's new levels of action. You know, let's have nunchucks, which was challenging.
his attitude and the talent, whether it's handling a gun, how it reloads, it's compelling to see him do it.
You armed?
John Wick action asks just a little bit more. And you see the effort and the commitment from the team. Ian McShane's back with Lawrence Fishburne and Lance Reddick. And then we have Donnie Yen.
Bill Skarsgård.
Hiroyuki Sanada. Clancy Brown. Shamir Anderson. And the incredible Natalia Tena.
Scott Adkins.
Fighting Keanu Reeves.
It's hard work, man.
And also we have Rina Sawayama.
We make it look easy, but it's not.
For chapter 4, we wanted to bring the muscle cars back.
We really wanted to do something different.
We're gonna have this sequence around the Arc de Triomphe.
We tore all the doors off and lost the windshield. You're gonna do a reverse 180, and you gotta shoot a gun, and you gotta reload. He actually started getting too good in the car.
We're smashing people, hitting people. It's just amazing.
We've shot some stuff that pushes John Wick to the limit.
Have we gone too far?
I can't even imagine the commitment level and how exhausting making these sequences must be. I can't even, it's at a whole new level. Now, coming up next, we're going to hear from one of the producers, Basil Iwanyk. And he's just going to talk about just how incredible Keanu Reeves is. And that when he first came out with the first John Wick, it just made everybody realize, man, is he awesome. And then right after that, we're going to hear from Keanu. And he's going to be talking about just in each movie, new things keep happening. And he says, well, why not this? Why not this? It's just fun listening to him talk about how everything just keeps getting developed by saying, well, why not?
It all starts with Keanu. I think that I think people love the first John Wick movie, but one of the reasons why I think it had such an impact was it was kind of a reintroduction. It was a reminder to the audience of why Keanu was such a great movie star and a great action star. And people fell in love with him again. A whole new generation did. And it also coincided with all these Keanu's a great guy, memes and stories. It was all true. He's one of the all-time good dudes. And so people were like rooting for Keanu and they were rooting for John Wick because he was such an underdog character. And so I think really the entry point into the franchise is Keanu and then the John Wick character.
When we have these ideas for films, you know, we've worked on Chapter 2, that idea of the club scene. Went from the red circle to now let's do the baths in Rome, you know, and what else could he do? He's running for his life. I think, what if he gets a horse and then starts to ride? Yeah, let's do that. And the character is still kind of running under the pressures of the high table at the end of 3. Are you pissed off? You know, Winston shot him off a building. He's excommunicado.
Now, coming up next, we're going to hear from the director again, and he's going to talk about collaborating with Keanu Reeves. And it's just like jumping off the cliff together. And immediately after that, we're going to hear from the great Mr. Keanu Reeves. And he's going to be talking about the director and collaborating with him, but also how they pull from all these different aspects to make this movie. And of course, they mention and think about the awesome, the good, the bad, and the ugly, and how that plays into this movie. And just listen to that interview with Keanu. It's going to be awesome. He's into the whole idea of all these things happening. You'll hear it. It's awesome.
I don't even know if I'd call it a collaboration. Yes, we collaborate, but like, I just think you have two people that are working together that love the same stuff. What's the Bob Fosse quote? You know, half of directing is coming up with really crazy ideas, and the other 50% is finding people crazy enough to pull them off. It starts with Keanu. And I think that's the main thing, is we trust you enough to step off the cliff together. What happens after that? I don't know.
Chad really hooked into this idea of trying to study John Wick, through the situations of other characters, and he was really drawn to the good, the bad, and the ugly.
And so enter Donnie Yen as Kane and Shamir Anderson as the Tracker.
We have Hiroyuki Sanada, who I worked with on 47 Ronin. He has a daughter who's working with him, and that's the incomparable Rina Sawayama.
And then the antagonist of the piece, the Marquis, Bill Skarsgård.
You're kind of following their stories as they're trying to get John Wick, and Kane and John Wick have a past. The Tracker is kind of a younger character who's kind of outside of it, who's not an assassin, but then gets kind of takes a deal to force to become an assassin, and these characters come after John, and then there's moments where we have to work together against the table. So that dynamic is a way of opening up the world. Who are these other characters that exist in this world? And then how do they interact with John, and how does John interact with them?
Now, in that interview, he mentions the good, the bad, and the ugly, and that whole genre. Up next, we're going to hear from the director, and he also talks about that. All these people that have inspired him, he talks about the good, the bad, and the ugly, Tarantino and Kurosawa, and how that really affected his filmmaking and what this movie's really about. So this is a really cool interview when he really gets into that, talking about grabbing and using those movies as inspiration in this film. And then right after that, we're going to have a clip. And in this movie clip, we have Keanu Reeves' character, John Wick. He's sitting at a table, and there's like three or four other guys sitting there. One guy has a gun pointing at everybody else. It's kind of like a giant standoff. And if you really look at it, it could be similar to the final scene in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, where everybody's standing there in a face-off, and what's going to happen. And that's what that scene is, in a sense. It's like, okay, I want to kill you. You want to kill me. And he wants to kill you. And Keanu goes, I want to kill you. And the guy's like, well, look what we have here. We have a conundrum. And that's just kind of what it's a build-up to what happens after that, which is obviously Bedlam. But in that scene, it's just them discussing what everybody wants and what's going
to
happen.
I try to rip off from the best. Like, let's start with that. You try to rip something off. You're trying to get this guy idea. I'm going to make good, the bad, the ugly. And then it starts morphing. And if you give the idea enough room and enough slack, it starts morphing and morphing and morphing and morphing. The trick is not to try and put a suit on that doesn't fit. So there's a lot of things that, boy, I would have loved to steal from Sergio Leone and Wong Kar-wai and Tarantino and Kurosawa and all this stuff, but like, yeah, it doesn't really fit. You start there and you go, what I love about it, I'm like, oh my God, that's genius. Then you start realizing, well, the genius is, you know, not just original thought, but it's original application of thought and how you do. And you start letting it loose, and you start letting go a little bit, and you start experiencing things in your character, and you start living back in your world and seeing what fits and what doesn't. Perspective, really. Three people, part of the same problem and the same solution. Everybody wants the gold. The gold is the thing. One guy wants for this reason, one guy wants for this reason, one guy wants for this. How do we make that more fun? How do we make that more wiki, and how do we do that? Okay, well, let's make John Wick the gold, and let's put a dilemma on that. Because in Leone's, if any one of the three gets the gold, they get it. The other two have nothing. It doesn't affect, they just didn't get it. Okay, bummer, they're just the same. Ours was, okay, well, if any one doesn't get to this one moment, everybody loses. They were all three different people all going, and like they all had a point, you know? So like that's fun about, and that fits into our Wiccan world where there are no good guys, period. There's just better bad guys. Like Wick is not a good, technically good guy. He's an assassin. Like he's living in this world. He just happens to have a code in this world that we feel attracted to. So doing that structure of good, the bad, the ugly with different perspectives, and you add in, you know, the character of the Marquis, Bill Skarsgård's character, who literally is the only person doing the right thing. It's kind of fun.
So, you want to kill him? You want to kill him? I want to kill him.
What about you, Mr. Vic?
I'm going to kill you.
Oh, for better, of course, yeah. But it looks like we have ourselves a genuine conundrum. A quandary, if you will. A real-life dilemma. So, I thought we play a game. One hand. The winner decides who lives and who does not.
Now, like they've been talking about, the good, the bad, and the ugly, when I hear the scene or when I see that scene, now it's just like I just see that movie in my head, Lee Van Cleef, Clint Eastwood, and of course, Eli Wallach. That is just a masterful scene. Now, if you've never seen The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, please, 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 please do yourself a massive favor. Sit down and bask in its glory, because that is truly like one of the pinnacles of filmmaking and, of course, Westerns. When you think of spaghetti Westerns, that is right there at the tippy, tippy top. So in case you've been denied that privilege because of John Wick, do yourself a favor. Because, hey, these guys like it. Why wouldn't you? So please give that movie a shot if you've never seen it, or revisit it, because it's worth it. But now we have a great set of interviews from the insanely awesome Lawrence Fishburne. This guy is just movie royalty. Everything he's in is just awesome. Anything he's in, I'll watch it. I don't even care what it is. I'm in. And in this interview, he says so many great things. He talks about the character, the relationship between his character, the Bowery King, to Wick, and have this good friendship for all these years. And it's just really cool. But then he talks about when he first saw the first movie, his reaction and what he did after that. And I love the honesty in this interview. It just cracked me up, but it made me admire him even more. And when you hear, you'll see what I'm saying. Priceless stuff. But then after that, we're going to hear from Keanu talking about how much he really, really enjoys Fishburne. That just having him there is just awesome. And then immediately after we hear from Keanu talking about Fishburne, we're going to have a scene. And in this scene, Keanu's in a subway, like where a train's coming down. Out walks the Bowery King, Lawrence Fishburne. And they just have this great conversation. But in this conversation, he hands him a suit. And the suit is Teflon. It's like bulletproof. It's just a cool little fun scene between two friends, A, in real life and in the movie.
I think the relationship with John Wick is really quite intimate, and that they did some of their best work together, maybe, in the early days. The relationship with John is great. And then Chad said something about Winston and the Bowery King, which is that they're kind of brothers in a way. I applaud him for being able to, like, continue to work in the action genre as hard as he does. Keanu's physicality in these movies is staggering. You know, the amount of stamina that is required, the amount of, like, just sheer kind of energy to do, you know, like even half of what he's required to do has got to be punishing, you know? He said something really, really kind of telling to me, which he said, I haven't spoken in like 15 weeks. I thought, he's after like an Eastwood kind of vibe, you know? When I saw the first movie, which I wasn't in, I enjoyed it so much. I immediately like reached out to Keanu. I was like, dude, all of our friends, all the guys that worked on the Matrix pictures, like everybody's in the movie. You got to hook me up. He was like, we've been thinking about you. And so, you know, to get to play a character who was this regal sort of monarch, but, you know, his kingdom is sort of underneath all of this sort of like highly stylized, elegant sort of chic that's happening is really kind of, it's a nice kind of juxtaposition. So I'm having fun, man. I'm just happy to be here.
The incredible Lawrence Fishburne as the Bowery King, where I had safe harbor. And for me personally, Fish is safe harbor. He's been such a mentor to me since working on The Matrix and 1997. So it's, you know, we have a friendship and it's cool to be working with him again. And what he brings to the Bowery King is so special. And who else could be the king?
Mama, Bonjour, Monsieur Wick, and welcome to La Resistance.
A little far from home, aren't you?
Well, your little act of uncivil disobedience inspired me, John. I'm branching out, spreading my wings. How goes the grand farewell tour?
Coming to an end.
So it seems, so it seems. 42 regular, wasn't it? It's Kevlar front to back, the latest in ballistic chic. Appropriate for all formal occasions. Weddings, funerals, high table duels. After all, a man has to look his best when it's time to get married. Or buried.
Married or buried. I just love that line. It just flows so well. Now, coming up next, we're going to hear a little bit more from Lawrence Fishburne. And he talks about when he first read the script. And he talks about also about how this there's so many more characters now as this movie series moves on. It's just exploding with so many cool characters. And then we're going to hear from one of the writers, Michael Finch. And what he talks about is the character Marquis. He's like one of the main guys of The Table. And is played by Bill Skarsgård. So he just talks about really more about who that character is and where he sits in this film.
When I read the script, I really, really loved all the different locations and these new characters that they've brought into the story. All those relationships, fathers and daughters. And I just thought, oh, wow, it's just like the world has gotten even like more outsized and more amazing. So I was just really, really happy that they asked me to come play.
In three, we had the adjudicator. The adjudicator was an official that came to correct some wrongs, to set things right. That didn't go so well. When we meet the Marquis, he is akin to the sheriff of this world. This is a man of great ambition. He's a man of tremendous power. He's something of a sadist. He's also a very powerful spokesman for what the table is and why John Wick has to die. The interesting thing about him, for me, is that he is a villain who believes he is the hero of his own story. He is doing God's work. He is on the side of right. John Wick is on the side of wrong. You know, that's up for interpretation. I think that some of us might disagree with that.
Now, coming up next, we're going to hear from the director. And he's going to talk about working with Bill Skarsgård, that he wrote a different character for him. But he says, no, I want to play this character. He's like, okay. And I love the reason why Skarsgård decided to take this, why he wanted that role. And it makes sense. I've heard that a lot. But then after that, we hear from Bill Skarsgård talking about when he first talked to the director. He's like, yeah, I want to do this. But then the next interview after that is really fascinating to me. It's producer Basil Iwanek. And he talks about creating a character and what you usually get in a villain. And what he describes is really fascinating. And I'm just going to let it go and let it play. But it's just interesting, the development process.
I've met Bill. I've talked with Bill for years now. I met him originally way back when my old partner, Dave Leach, had used him on Atomic Blonde. Had briefly spoken to him and been a big fan of his whole career. I've been dying to work with him. Thought I was going to do it for a part that is no longer in the movie. We had written a part I thought he'd be great for. So I sent him the script and he came back and he's like, no, I want to be that guy. I'm like, you want to be the bad guy? He's like, yeah, that's where all the fun is. I'm like, I could be so lucky. I literally got him the next day.
I was a huge fan of the franchise. I think they're really fun. I think Chad is one of the best action directors out there. I've met him a few times before and then he approached me with this thing and I said, oh yeah.
What we love about Bill is, you know, again, we were talking about that a lot of our villains or a lot of our characters are on the older side. You know, there are ones that have gone through and grizzled veterans. And we made a conscious decision to bring some youth in, not because we were trying to play to the audience, but just to see the contrast between the old guns and the new guns. And for the Marquis, who we needed to be one of the most loathsome characters in all four movies, someone to be hated so much, we wanted to go with youthful punk. And we wanted also to go with that great face that is able to express kind of a fake, again, formalism that we have, and a politeness. And Bill's, the contrast he has with Ian McShane and with Lance Reddick, you're just going to hate him. And we wanted that kind of, you know, bad guys could look like Michael Nyquist, you know, just beat up and, and bad guys could look, you know, like, you know, a 6'5" bruiser, or bad guys could look like Bill's character, the Marquis, who are clean cut and were mannered, classy. But in some ways, those are the ones you hate the most.
Now, they were discussing Bill Sarsgaard's character, but up next, we're going to hear from Bill, and he's going to be talking a little bit about the table, the mystery of it all, that nobody even really knows who's in charge or what it all means. But it's that's what's cool about it. It's just kind of all secretive. It's kind of like this mystic whole people of power. And then after that, we're going to hear from the director again, and he's going to be talking about dressing Bill Skarsgård, the character, because every scene is shot differently in a different tone, different thing, but he's always in these very dapper outfits, looking just crisp, and just talking about the duality between his character and John Wick, and how they light him, how they dress him, and how that all plays into a scene. And I just love hearing about that kind of stuff. And then after that, we're going to hear from Skarsgård, also talking about that, about he gets to wear all these cool suits and, you know, just all these fun elements that make up a character. And then immediately after that, we're going to have a scene. And the scene takes place in Paris. You have John Wick, Skarsgård's character, and they're doing this little deal about they're flipping over, like, they're not cards, but they're like metal cards, or like they're hard versions of it, and they keep flipping them over saying, we're going to duel with guns, or we're going to duel with this. And it's all done in, you know, they don't even show us what's on the cards. It's just this whole duel thing, kind of in a sense of, this is what we're going to do, and those two just kind of feeling each other out.
The way Chad described him to me is he's sort of the new sheriff in town. I'm not quite sure exactly how the table works and the structure of it, and it's purposefully kept a bit of a secret and a mystery in the world of John Wick. But he's appointed at a high position to, surprise, surprise, track down and kill John Wick. And he's kind of been elevated to this position, and he's off his leash, which means that he could basically implement whatever he wants and whatever he thinks is necessary to get it done.
You can imagine what a bad guy role in a John Wick would be. Like, we all have that stereotype in our head. Older gentleman, white, got the look, and he's got the plot and plan. He's got the scowl or something, you know, like that kind of thing. Or the witty, intelligent, you know, guy that you don't see coming, the jolly guy, you know. Bill went a whole different direction. Okay, I'm going to have this weird French Cajun accent. I'm going to be, I love fashion and wardrobe and playing with that. So I just knew right off the bat I wanted, you know, a certain type of wardrobe. I know I wanted to change suits every time. I wanted this opulence that is almost comical to a point. And one of the things, Bill had done this GQ photo shoot a while ago when he's in suits, and I was just like, fucking guy can wear a suit. So, like, we're going to change suits. We're going to hold, like, you're just going to trust me with it. We're going to do a triple Windsor knot. We're going to do all this. I'm going to put silver thread in your clothes. It's going to kick light. It's going to be weird. This thing is going to be, no matter what we do, our whole Greek mythology vibe into John Wick is, whenever I shoot you, you're going to be the good guy. You're going to be the guy in light and bright, and Keanu's always going to be dark and black, and you're going to be this shining hope. You're going to be Zeus on Mount Olympus, and Keanu will be down in Hades.
There's a bit of a Western flair to his outfit, sort of like mid to late 1800s cut of the suits. Paco is obviously an amazing costume designer, and I think he had a lot of fun with it. There's a lot of black suits with black ties in this franchise, and the Marquis gives it a little bit more of a sparkle, I guess. Every location, there's a different suit, different color, and it's glitter and gold, so what's not to like about it?
You come here thinking there is a way out of this world for you, Mr. Wick. There is not. The Centre Pompidou.
Sacré-Cœur. Sacré-Cœur. Weapons.
If you win, the table will honor its word. You will have your freedom. but you won't take it. Blades.
Pistols.
Dueling pistols. 30 paces. In the event that both parties survive, each will approach the other at increments of 10 paces until only one remains.
Now, coming up next, we're going to hear from Bill Skarsgård and their director talking about just the awesomeness of Keanu Reeves. But what I like about the director's interview is him really talking about Keanu taking up the character and what the character believes. Because if the character believes it could happen, it could be in the movie, and vice versa with Keanu Reeves. Like, once he puts on that outfit, he's the man. And then immediately after they talk about him, we're going to play another scene for you. And like I always say from time to time in episodes where there's a scene with no dialogue, you know, I always struggle if I should play it or not. But if you've seen the movie, if you do plan to see the movie, you'll understand what I'm saying, or you'll understand by hearing this. But in this scene, Keanu Reeves is in a car and it has an old door on it, and he's just being chased by all these people with all this traffic flying around. So you can hear cars flying by and just hear traffic. And it might not make sense, but you get the general tone of the scene and just all the action that this movie has, and it is a lot.
He's Keanu Reeves. Like, I grew up with the Matrix franchise and, like, been a big fan of his ever since I was a kid. And he really cares.
I think the trick is Keanu. Keanu and I discussed it ad nauseum many, many times. John Wick doesn't know he's in a movie. John Wick believes he is John Wick. And Keanu puts on the suit, he believes he is that guy. Like, that's the anchor. And the cast follows Keanu. They go, well, if he's taking it serious, I'm going to take it serious. And then we make fun of ourselves. It's that simple. Like, that's the only true north we stay by. The rest, that goes back to jumping the shark and all that stuff. Like, look, if John Wick believes that could happen, it's in the movie.
See what I'm saying? Action abound. Now, coming up next, just kind of talking about the whole concept of John Wick, where he's been, where he's going. We're going to hear from producer Erica Lee, and then we're going to hear from Keanu Reeves, and then producer Basil Iwanek, and then back to the mighty and awesome Keanu Reeves.
The action genre existed, but was sort of, you know, a little bit, I think, perceived down market. And the spin on John Wick was not only putting Keanu at the center of it, an actor that everyone loved, but really telling it a different way. And the aesthetic and the long takes and the gun-fu and kind of all the things that make it specific were born. But we really tried to push the envelope with the storytelling and cast great actors. And we keep pushing that further and further. And now on John Wick 4, we've taken it even further. We're sort of, you know, have European vibes. We've left New York. The movie is bigger. The cast is more sprawling. The movie is not just about Keanu anymore. It's a much bigger canvas. So it's been really fun to kind of watch the evolution of that.
Yeah. I mean, as soon as Derek Kolstad had these assassins come into this house to attack John Wick, and once John Wick took care of business, brought these gold coins and said, you know, I'd like to make a reservation. It was like, whoa, okay. Well, what can that turn into? What is this other world? And it's been a wonderful pleasure to come up with things, you know, like, what are these rules? And at the base of that too is Chad's belief that the more kind of ceremony that we can present with the high table is good to elevate them, because we don't want to show the faces. Like, we don't want to do like, here's a table and there's 12 of them and they're all sitting like, no, you don't see them. You never see them. But I think we can all relate to the idea of them. And so it's been cool to tap into that personally and then to put it into the art and then have that as this kind of overarching thing. And then have a character seeking a kind of liberation from that.
I think John Wick 4 is now a big tentpole epic film that has huge sets and vistas. And every decision we make on this film is the dream of sitting in the theater and watching it on a big screen. And I think that, you know, we can put aside what's going to happen with, you know, just where we are going to be as a society in terms of communal experiences and stuff. I desperately miss the movies. And I miss all kinds of movies, but I definitely miss that movie that you wait in line for, you get your popcorn, the theater's packed, you feel the energy, and then it's literally as soon as a character comes on the screen, people clap because they're just happy to see that character again. That's John Wick 4. On the first film from the fourth film, when audiences watch the action, they laugh. And they're not laughing because they're laughing at it. It's just like they're laughing because it's a ride. It's a thrill. And that, to me, is why I think people want to go back to the movies, to get that collective thrill. And that's what we're going for.
If you enjoy the world building of the John Wicks, then we have some really a lot of fun stuff in store. We have new characters, new levels of action for John Wick action, the production design, the scale, the scope, a lot of big rooms, high ceilings. We're in Berlin, we're in Paris. We have amazing thespians and costume design. There's other themes that are coming back from all of different versions of all of the films. So there's stuff that you can recognize, and then there's new things. We're trying to cook up a beautiful feast with multiple courses and some nice wine. So sit back, see it on the big screen, eat some popcorn, and John Wick.
Now, unfortunately, we have recently lost the incredibly talented, brilliant performer, Lance Reddick. This guy's filmography is massive. The man did so much work, and we just sadly lost him way too soon. But you might remember him from the TV show Oz, the show Bosch, which is incredible. If you never watched the show Bosch, it's a Prime TV show. It's amazing, and his character is just solid. And he was also in the TV show Lost. And I could go on and on. Just look at his filmography. The man was in high demand for voice work, acting, you name it. And it's just so sad knowing he's not going to be in any more of these movies or anything else. And it's just, I just had to address that because what an incredible loss. Because he did so much for entertainment. And coming up next, we're going to hear Keanu Reeves. He's going to be talking about Lance Reddick. But unfortunately, this interview was done before he passed, so he's just kind of talking about him and this the character that he plays. But then after that, I'm just going to play a few of the Lance Reddick interviews that were put aside for this show, for the movie. And I just wanted to have you hear him talk about the movie.
If they like John Wick, they like him because Sharon likes him. And I think what Lance brought to the role of Sharon, even from the beginning, I think it wasn't even rehearsal. It was like we were on the set and we were kind of there. And Lance said to Chad, I have this accent that I've always wanted to do. Chad was like, let's hear it. And so he did it. And then Chad was like, okay. And Lance was like, really? He's like, yeah. And so Sharon was born. And the elegance of that performance and that person and, you know, just kind of the heart of that character. You know, you feel it when John Wick walks into the hotel lobby the first time and he just kind of looks up.
One of the things that's so interesting about that relationship is it feels so close from the first film, particularly Sharon. He seems like he's calling the manager every other scene, but you don't really see them together until the very end of the second film. We didn't really have any scenes together until the third film. But the way the relationship plays out in the third film, it almost informs what happened before in the first two films. So you get a sense that they've been together for many, 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 many years, probably even before the Continental. It's so funny because the first time I ever met Ian was in that scene at the end of John Wick 2. So I've been a fan, but I'd never met him before. As a matter of fact, when I first met Ian at the very end of John Wick 2, I was being very weird because I was kind of tongue-tied, and he was just, hey, man, how you doing? And I was like, oh, the, and he was looking at me like, what's the matter with you? You okay? And that's really when we became friends. We were visited by someone called the Harbinger, who lets us know that the High Table is not pleased with the fact that Winston let John Wick live. And so, you know, in the confrontation, or rather, depending on how you want to put it, confrontation and meeting, Winston goes to meet the Marquis, who is the representative of the High Table, to plead the case. Troughton decides to go with him, because the truth is, both of them aren't summoned, only Winston is. And there's a moment where, right before they go into the room to meet with the Marquis, where Winston says to him, you know, you shouldn't be here.
Well, he should be here, and he will be greatly missed. But the greatest part of all this, with all his work, all his art, he will be eternal. That's the footprint he left. His body of work will last for years and years. You'll be missed, sir. Well, I hope you enjoyed our in-depth look at John Wick Chapter 4. If you guys have any questions, comments, concerns, any way to improve the show, let me know. CinemaJudge@Hotmail.com. Or look me up at Instagram, The Cinema Judge, YouTube, a whole bunch of TikTok, wherever you want to go. I'm on most platforms. I can't grow if I don't know. So I would love your feedback. Now, like I said earlier in the show, this is always a TV version first. I convert that into this. And if you want to watch that, go to either Bloomington, Minnesota's webpage and type in Cinema Judge, or go to bit.ly/cinemajudge. There you'll find this and several other shows on demand and watch whenever you want, 24 hours a day. And like I always tell people this, you won't see or hear me on that at all. When I make the TV version, it's strictly audio, video. I don't interrupt at all. It's the stars, you get to see them, and everything else, so you don't have to worry about me rambling on endlessly. But now, it's my favorite part of the show, where I thank you, the listeners, who listened to my last episode. And some of you might say, hey dude, I listened to a past episode and you didn't mention me one bit. Well, the reason why that is, it's easier to mention people who listened to the last episode. I love it when people listen to the past episodes, because I see it. But trying to determine who, what, where, when, where, or whatever is virtually impossible, because it's a long story. But it's always easier just to say who listened to the last episode. So thank you to the current listening at the last episode and anybody who listened to the past ones. But this is for all you guys who listened to the last episode. And I love that. I love hearing how you listen to this show. Whether you're just sitting at home on a long drive or just sitting around doing the laundry or your dishes, whatever you're doing, I love hearing about that. So wherever, whenever, or whatever you're doing, this is for you. All my listeners from the United States, Uzbekistan, Germany, Minneapolis, Minnesota, Tashkent, Littleton, Colorado, Mount Pleasant, South Carolina, Denver, Colorado, Madison, Wisconsin, Orlando, Florida, Pasadena, Texas, Dillon, Colorado, Morrisville, Pennsylvania, North Hollywood, California, Lake Forest, California, Eden Prairie, Minnesota, Plymouth, Michigan, Valencia, California, South Hadley, Mass., Kent, Ohio, Detroit Lakes, Minnesota, Frankfurt AM, Maine, Hesse, and Highlands Ranch, Colorado. Every solitary one of you, I am so grateful for you taking time out of your busy life to listen to this show. I am eternally grateful, and I thank you from the bottom of my heart. And this week's bourbon shout-out goes out to a few of you guys. First, Muhammad, thank you very much for letting me talk about movies. Michael, you know who you are. You've listened to me ramble about movies for years upon years, and I am so grateful. You're nothing but just a giant ball of joy. Every time I see you, I just say, man, Miguel the Great, you're just awesome. and the scheduling genius guru. You know who you are. I appreciate all your hard work and for listening, sharing it with your coworkers. So to you, the guru of scheduling, I salute you. And there's one more I got to thank. And it's to, I can't even tell you how long I've known this guy. Since elementary school, while I was doing the show tonight, he gave me a call, so we chatted, so I got rudely interrupted doing the show. So if any flow got messed up to you guys, you could blame him. But we talked for a little bit, and to you, Mr. Carlson, I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed our adventures all through life. And I got to tell you guys, this is not an exaggeration. I owe that guy my life, because way back in the day, during those days of wild youth adventures, we were climbing over a fence in at Minnehaha Park or Minnehaha Falls. And of course, where it says do not enter, what did we do? Of course, we entered. We remember walking down the hill, and I remember slipping, and I was going to go over. He just casually reached out, grabbed the back of my shirt, pretty much grabbed me out of midair and pulled me back in. And just like, hey, man, okay. And I've never forgotten that. But that's just the tip of the iceberg of our wicked wild adventures and how we survived it all. I'll never know. But I truly got to thank you, my brother. All the years, all the bedlam, thank you. So to every one of you, cheers. But now it's the music section. As I alluded to earlier, as you all know, this starts off as a TV show. Then I make it into this. But when I'm doing a TV version, I don't have to worry about talking, audio, nothing. So usually when I'm doing the TV version of it, I'm cranking tunes. Because that's my happy place. Between movies and music, that's always just been my life, my little safe haven. When I can combine them both, when I'm editing the show, it's all I ever need, really. It's like, I got it. I'm sitting here in my basement, rocking in my chair and rocking with the music. It's my happy place. So this week, I wanted kind of like go with the theme of the movie, kind of just a fun plug and play type thing. So I first threw down Joan Jett and the Blackhearts. I played her greatest hits or their greatest hits, however you want to say it. But what more do you mean? Just the ultimate plugging in the guitar and just throwing down some riffs. Man, did she have some great tunes, and she still tours with force. Sometimes you just need a little Joan Jett. You're like, yep, rock it out. She knows how to throw down. And then from there, I went to Pat Benatar and her greatest hits. Because again, you can't go wrong with Pat Benatar. She's solid all the time. Great tunes. Give both them a listen. You won't regret it. But then I moved on to Coldplay. And I have so many memories with them. And again, as you listen to the show, I don't listen to quote newer bands a lot. And I know they're not new, but in my realm of musical tastes, they're relatively new. But I went through a couple of their albums because this episode took me quite a long time to do. So I threw down some Coldplay. But then I felt I really needed another kick. I need a little bit more oomph to get me through the episode and to stay in the same tone. So then I went on to the legendary god of guitars, Jimi Hendrix. That's one of my, when I really need something just to throw down and have a good time. So many memories with Hendrix growing up. And he's one of those bands where I don't think I have any emotional baggage connected to his songs. You know, because most bands that we know, you associate it with a time of your life or whatever. With him, it's just, there's no emotional baggage. Just, I mean, really good memories, but nothing negative or, oh, I remember this. Oh, it all really bummed me out or whatever. With him, it's just nothing but solid memories. So I threw down first Axis Bold as Love. Incredible album. That was the second album. Axis Bold as Love. Incredible songs on there. And that album would have even been better. And it's wonderful. But in my mind, it would have been exceptional. But back in the day, what happened was, I think Jimmy or somebody, they were in a cab and they had the master tapes with them. And he forgot one whole side of the album in the back of that cab, and they never found it. So in order to get the album out, they had to pretty much rush through and just try to crank out those songs from memory. So I always wondered, what if those tapes are out anywhere? Who has them? Are they in somebody's attic or whatever? But I wonder if that album would have been a different feel if they would have had the proper time and used the real tapes that they had originally. Anyway, it's just kind of a fun little tale. And then I went on to this, the double album, incredible variety on this one. It's his last album he made, Electric Ladyland. It has 18 songs on it, and the variety on this album is amazing. And the stuff that he sang about, if you only know his hits, that's fine. He has some great hits. But if you delve into Electric Ladyland and also Access Bold as Love, there are legendary songs on there. And some of the songs are so, like, there's a couple of them that are just massively long, but you don't even know. You don't even notice it. They do jam sessions, and it's bluesy, jazzy, rock, mystical. It's the stuff that he has on those albums are amazing. The depth of what he would have done if he had lived, because he was really finding his voice in his writing, his musical styles. It wasn't just guitar wizardly. He was really going in some weird, cool, amazing directions. So the world really missed out of what he could have done, where he was going. But if you ever have a shot, listen to those two albums. I mean, the first album is perfect. I mean, it has hit after hit after hit. But Access Bold as Love and Electric Ladyland, you'll truly understand Jimmy when you hear those. Well, guys, I got long-winded on this episode, but I truly hope you enjoyed it, because that is it. My glass awaits. I'm thirsty. So cheers to you and to the movies. So until next time, be well, be good, and I'm gone. I'm Jeff. Thanks for listening to The Cinema Judge.